Hello, welcome to In Your Nature podcast with me, Ricky Whelan.
And with me, Niall Hatch. Great to have you all back listening to us. Thanks again for all the kind comments that people are sending us about the podcast. It's nice to know that you like listening to it. And just to start off by saying, the In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Leash and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage. This podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly. Okay, so Ricky, so what have we got lined up for today?
Yeah, so today it's a bit of a public service announcement. Maybe not such a fun, upbeat topic and not as exciting as some of the birds we've been talking about and bits and bobs. But today, I think we have a duty of care with everything that's going on around the place to talk about avian flu and fill people in a bit about that.
Yes, it's been in the news quite a lot recently. And at the time of recording this podcast, we've been really worried about the impacts potentially on seabird colonies around the Irish coast. We know that this disease has caused big problems for seabirds elsewhere in Europe and indeed in North America as well. So that's a concern. And of course, we humans now, we probably found ourselves all becoming amateur virologists over the last 2 years. You know, we've been more, I suppose, aware of the risks of pandemics and perhaps the risks of diseases in wild animals spreading to humans potentially and causing disease that way. So good time to be talking about this and to have it on the radar, I suppose. You're right, it's kind of a public part of our public service remit, Ricky.
We actually now know that there's been 2 confirmed cases of avian flu on our coast. We know on the 8th of July, a raven off the coast of Kerry was confirmed with avian flu. And we also know on the 15th, a guillemot in Donegal was tested positive. The carcass was tested positive for the disease as well. And that's H5N1 we're talking about. That's the sort of highly pathogenic avian influenza. That's what we're talking about here. That's when you hear them refer to avian flu, bird flu, in 90% of the cases, that's the sort of strain we're talking about.
Yes, and so obviously concerning to know that this has reached Ireland. We know that in Northern Ireland there were some dead birds found on Rathlin Island as well, but particularly in Scotland and in the north of England, there were huge die-offs of birds at some of the colonies there. The really important tern colony in Coquet Island in England has been pretty much annihilated by this disease. So the fear has been that in the close confines of a seabird colony, if an infected bird or infected droppings or something do end up in there, it spreads like wildfire through all those birds. They're all crammed in so tight together. Seabird colonies aren't the most sanitary places at the best of times. They'd be a real sort of hotbed and incubator for these pathogens. I think it is reassuring, at least to say, Ricky, that despite the fact that those 2 birds were discovered and were unfortunately found to have had this strain of avian flu, it doesn't seem, as far as we know, to have spread into the seabird colonies. And I was particularly nervous about the raven in Kerry, because of course some of Europe's most important seabird colonies are in Kerry. You have obviously Skellig Michael and Little Skellig there. You have Puffin Island and a whole lot of other areas there too. So if the disease got into the populations on those islands at this sensitive time of year in the middle of the breeding season, it could be an absolute disaster.
Yeah, definitely. And it's very, very strange that the disease has reached both Kerry and Donegal, but nothing sort of in between. And we've an awful lot of colonies along the west coast, which people will be keeping an eye on. But I do know anecdotally that Kittiwakes look in a bad shape on the Clare coast. And people will know the Cliffs of Moher will probably refer to a lot of sort of mysterious, islands off the east coast of England and stuff that people might be familiar with. But everyone's familiar with the sort of the Cliffs of Moher. So, but it looks like, apparently, and I'm just going on sort of anecdotal evidence and some hearsay at the moment, but it looks like the guillemots and stuff aren't affected, and most of them have already sort of started to disperse, which is good. They might have just got out of just in time, but unfortunately it looks like Kittiwake, something's certainly affecting them there, but I don't think there's been carcasses recovered because of the nature of the site, but I suppose that remains to be seen. Very, very scary stuff coming from the east coast of the UK, and there's a piece of coastline I suppose people be most familiar with. It's between Newcastle and Edinburgh, I suppose. It's the Northumberland coast, and there's a couple of colonies there, Niall, you might fill us in on, but I mean there's Bass Rock, which is home to, is it the largest gannetry in England?
It's the largest in the world. It's the most important site for that species in the whole world, and we know that it's had big problems. And of course it's just a short flight as a gannet flies, at least from there then through the Irish Sea to the gannetries we have off Dublin at Howth at Ireland's Eye, Lambay Island, and then down to Wexford to the Salty Islands where you know another big concentration of those seabirds. So yeah, concerning.
It's scary stuff. And again, you mentioned Cockett Island, the tern colony, they're decimated this year. And then the Farns is on that patch of the coast as well, the Farn Islands. It's a famous warden sort of a group of islands, and they're looking in bad shape with their seabirds as well. So really, really grim pictures in the UK. And the problem is, seabirds in those colonies are quite tightly packed. Mm-hmm. The disease is spread through sort of bodily fluids, through sort of even the feces, the guano of the seabirds. And unfortunately, whatever, just for the nature of the sites, those sites are full of it.
Yes, absolutely. You notice it as soon as you go anywhere near them. You can even smell them even if you're miles away in some cases, because that's how seabirds live. They're droppings all over the place. They live in close proximity to each other. The reason why these colonies are so successful for seabirds in the first place is because they're so remote, and many of them originally free from predators. Thankfully, many of them still are. So it's a good safe place for them to raise their chicks. But then there is the problem when they're all so closely packed, if disease spreads, it can hit very rapidly. And it's been heartbreaking seeing some of the scenes from those UK islands where literally the ground is carpeted in dead birds. And there's obviously then risk to potentially to humans there as well, which is something we shouldn't shy away from. Not to alarm people, and there's no need to be overly concerned. But the big fear would be, of course, that this disease could spread from these wild birds into human population. Now, most people in their ordinary walks of life, they don't come in contact with seabirds at these colonies. But people like our colleagues, Ricky, who are warding on places like Rockabilly Island or Ladies Island Lake down in Wexford, they do on a regular basis. And so we've had to take special precaution just to make sure, absolutely sure, that they're completely safe with all the proper PPE and everything as well, and to make sure that there's no risk of contamination there. But this obviously is a concern. Now, there are no cases yet of this disease having jumped across the species barrier and infected humans. The strain that hasn't happened in with this current outbreak. If it did, the fear would be, of course, that it could turn into something like COVID and would spread from human to human. The birds would be taken out of the equation completely. But thankfully that hasn't happened, and hopefully it won't. And hopefully, as you said, Ricky, that most of our seabirds will be able to get away from the colonies, that the young will be reared before this disease reaches them. I honestly would have expected them to be worse hit by this stage, given what's happened in the UK. But they seem to have so far avoided the worst of it, at least at the time of recording.
We're more familiar with bird flu and H5N1 in the wintertime, Niall, yes, aren't we? And we more often see the last few winters we've had outbreaks of it to various sort of degrees. But water birds tend to be affected by it. And the issue in winter is the days are shorter, the days are colder. So the virus tends to live on a bit longer and survive better among birds and in the environment, and it spreads then amongst tightly packed migratory water birds that all pack into sort of our lovely wetlands around the country because they're overwintering here. Is that what's happening?
That's exactly. And I think that the barnacle geese were the species that perhaps worst affected. The full extent of that problem isn't known. We have a big population of barnacle geese that winter, particularly in the northwest of Ireland. They tend to sleep, like roost offshore on islands at night, come into mainland sites to graze during the day. And we know that their numbers were badly hit this year. So that's certainly a concern. We've seen big die-offs in Scotland of the same species too, which was very scary. But I think you're absolutely right. What's happening there is that these birds are living in very close proximity in flocks. Also, the fact that they're water birds, it makes sense as well, because this is very often a waterborne virus. And it's a very tough virus, much more so than the COVID virus, which a lot of people have become familiar with lately. I've heard that it can actually survive in water for up to 200 days without a host, which is quite unusual for a virus. Normally, viruses need to pass from host to host relatively quickly, or they fail to reproduce and they die off. But this is much more prevalent, I suppose, within the environment. So these infections can persist there like that. Often with these migratory birds, what happens as well is that they pick it up at other points on their migratory journey. These wild birds, they often get blamed for this problem. But I think, the root cause of it, where all these strains originate, it's in parts of Asia, in poultry farms, particularly the massive duck and goose farms that occur. In some of those, unfortunately, the conditions are quite unsanitary. The biosecurity isn't very good. So some of these birds get infected, the virus passes between birds and new strains mutate and develop very rapidly. And if those birds are allowed access to wild geese, which are migratory and will move around, what can happen is some of those can pick up that infection. Then they fly back north to somewhere like Siberia. Then it gets present in the waterways, the water courses there. They may infect some of the waders there, some of the ducks as well. They're all mingling in those same waterways. And then some of those birds will in turn head sort of westwards and go towards Europe and maybe infect someone like the Netherlands. And then some of those birds end up in Ireland. So that's how it spreads. But our message has always been that the birds are the victims of this rather than the vectors. It's a human caused problem, as are so many things these days, unfortunately. And often with the spread of these strains of avian flu, it's often first detected as spreading in usually quite straight lines along railway and road networks as domestic poultry are being transported across Asia into Europe and moving around that way. And then it's the birds that pick it up from there in the wild and then spread it on. They tend to die quite quickly. So actually the chance of these birds surviving long enough to spread it terribly far, it seems to be minimized, although we still don't fully understand that and whether it's possible for birds to be asymptomatic and still carry the disease and infect others. Still a lot we have to learn.
Question. You're going to have the likes of house sparrows, starlings, those kind of species, potentially pigeons, feral pigeons, knocking around those types of poultry farms, even in this country, in Europe and in Asia and across the whole range. Can our passerines and our garden birds get this disease?
It's unknown, to be honest, Ricky. So far, we haven't seen any cases of that. And I think that they have, they're probably a bit safer than the seabirds or the water birds would be just because of their behaviours. Yes, they do flock, but they're not submerging themselves in water to quite the same extent. They're not competing over exactly the same food resources. So there may be a risk there, but it's much lower than it would be for a lot of our water birds. Having said that, we've seen the problem with greenfinches, particularly this disease, trichomoniasis, which does seem to spread like wildfire through their flocks. It can affect some other finches as well. So certainly in the right conditions, diseases can transmit between these birds. But certainly the message we have at the moment is that people shouldn't be concerned about feeding birds in their garden or so on. The risk is, at the moment, it seems negligible. This disease has not been detected in those populations. However, the fact that one of the birds that we know for certain has been infected in Ireland was a raven, which is a songbird, it's a passerine, would suggest that this can spread between many, many different types of birds, even ones that aren't very closely related.
Yeah, I know the list of species across globally that have been affected or you know, tested positive for it is quite huge, and there is a few passerines among them, but it's not hugely common, and certainly sort of it doesn't spread like wildfire among them. I don't know if it's because they're a bit smaller, less flocking behaviour, that they die off quicker and stuff like that. They're not lying around a sort of a colony and every other bird's picking them up and all that sort of stuff. The problem we have, and the conversation in the office and the fear seabird conservationists will have, is that the likes of the terns now are post-breeding. They've finished their season more or less, are finishing up, and they'll scatter to the four winds. They will all coalesce in various sort of staging sites before they head south to Africa. And potentially there's a big influx of UK birds heading our way that might stage on the likes of Sandy Mount Strand, like we go to see every autumn before they head south to Africa. So we could be looking at another sort of surge in the next couple of weeks and months.
It's certainly possible. Yes, that big tern roost you get on Sandy Mount Strand each autumn, it's an amazing sight, and people should, it's well worth seeing. I would definitely recommend it to people. But we know that those are birds. Many of them are Irish birds, but we know there are birds coming from Britain, probably some from places like the Netherlands, staging there before going off on migration. They're heading down to places like Africa. In the case of the Arctic tern, our Arctic terns breeding in places like Dalkey Island, in a few months' time they'll be in Antarctica, down around penguins and species like that. So it just shows how this disease could potentially spread around the world because of the problems when it gets into migratory bird populations. We know as well that there's quite a lot of interchange in terns, like little terns, for example, between Wales and Ireland. They cross the Irish Sea quite frequently. We know they breed in one side of the Irish Sea one year and maybe go across the other side the following year. We know all this through the ringing data on the little metal rings that are put on the bird's legs. So they do move around a lot more than people might assume. And these movements, it's not just necessarily at the main migration time. There's this staging beforehand when they are moving around, trying to find the best feeding areas after the chicks have been reared. There are certainly concerns there, and it's important we keep an eye out for that. It's also very important, too, that proper biosecurity is in place in poultry farms. The farming industry, obviously, in Ireland is very important. Poultry farming is not insignificant in part of that sector. And the economic, potentially the economic impact of bird flu means that it's actually the Department of Agriculture here in Ireland that takes the lead on investigating potential outbreaks and on testing and so on. So it's obviously really important that the biosecurity measures are put in place so that it doesn't spread into domestic poultry flocks, because that's when it can have a really serious economic impact. I think as well, Ricky, it's worth pointing out too with seabirds, perhaps why they're more impacted than other birds would be, because they've got a different breeding strategy, don't they? So if you look at the robins and the blue tits and the wrens in your garden, they have very short lifespans. Their natural lifespan is 2 or 3 years, give or take. And so during the course of that life, that short life, what they do is they lay as many eggs as possible so they can try raise as many chicks as possible. So your robins in your garden may have 2 broods a year. Your blue tit may only have 1 brood, but it'll have 8 to 10 chicks at a go. And so over the course of 2 or 3 years, they're producing dozens of chicks. And ultimately, all that has to happen is 2 survive to replace their parents in the population. But if something happens that reduces the population of those birds, like with wrens, for example, we often see this. If there's a very, very cold winter, many, perhaps even the majority of our wrens will die. But those that survive, the following year they go on to breed, they have lots of chicks, and more of those chicks will survive than otherwise would, because there's vacant territories, there's food available for them, they can fit right in. For seabirds, the strategy for most of them is very different. They'll often lay, often in many cases, just 1 egg per year. For some species, even once every 2 years. It takes them a lot longer to reach breeding maturity, but they have a longer lifespan. So they'll live for longer. It means that they have more chances to produce enough chicks to replace themselves in the population, but they can do this over the course of decades. However, when a disaster strikes, like a disease outbreak or perhaps an oil spill or something like that, it means that when the adults are killed off, it can take a very long time for that population to build back to its previous levels, just because that reproductive rate is so low.
It's quite frightening. And again, we're back to seabirds. There'd be an awful lot of seabird biologists and conservationists sort of fearing the worst in that regard. And again, going back to the picture, like it's a really horrible disease in a way. I mean, I remember last winter, it was really distressing to see photos and videos of swans, hooper swans and mute swans. I don't know what it is, such a big, beautiful bird sort of dying sort of slowly. It just gets to you a bit more than, you know, a mallard or something. I don't know why I put them on a pedestal, but there's just something about a swan that really gets to you, and they're just so stunning. But the disease causes like nerve damage before that. They're twisting and they're contorting and they're rocking and they're vibrating. It's actually very difficult to watch.
It is. It's very distressing, Ricky. It is. And the symptoms, of course, that people should watch out for in birds, you know. Just to point out, birds die all the time for various reasons. So if you find a dead bird, it doesn't necessarily mean that it has avian flu by any means. But if you do start to see these weird twisting, sort of writhing behavior, the sort of lethargy that they get as well, that's another symptom of this as well. And it tends to strike very quickly. We've seen some of the seabird colonies in Britain. We've seen them go from being fit and healthy to within a couple of days, dead birds all over the place. It seems to strike really hard and really fast. So we would ask people to keep an eye out for that. And of course, if people do see anything suspicious, they do see any problems with birds dying off, particularly multiple deaths of birds, we're asking people please to report that. There's a special hotline and a web service and an app as well run by the Department of Agriculture. If you go to our website, birdwatchireland.ie, and look in the news section there, you'll see the most up-to-date news on avian flu. And we'll keep that updated all the time as well. So no doubt there will be developments after this podcast has been released. And we will keep everything updated on the website there, so you'll know exactly where to go to and who to report things to as the situation evolves.
Yeah, I'll repeat that because no doubt we'll get queries about it. So there's a couple of different ways you can report it to the department. There's the regional veterinary office. You just Google that and you'll get the relevant number for your region. The DFAM, the disease hotline, believe it or not, there's such a thing. Those numbers do go in and out of sort of use. So just Google it and you'll get the current one, or as Niall says, go onto our website news section and you'll get it. And then there is an app, the Bird Check app as well. If you Google that, you'll find it and you can download it and put in. I know it's reported that the department are only collecting and testing birds where they're found in numbers. They won't test sort of single birds because it could be just anything. It could be a sort of car fatality, it could be a predator kill, it could be just a, you know, age, whatever. So as you said, birds are killed. So if it's sort of seabird stuff, and there's a few of them, definitely report them today and let the department make up their mind whether they want to collect the carcasses or whatever. I would say further advice is don't handle the carcass. If you're out with the dog walking on the beach and you're starting to see carcasses, put them back on the lead. You don't want the dog sort of dragging anything home or getting that in, you know, ingesting anything either. And Yeah, just report it, stay well away from it, and that's all you can do, really.
Yeah, we have to be vigilant about this. And I know it's been heartbreaking for a lot of people out there who work in either as professional staff or as volunteers in wildlife rehabilitation, because a lot of the wildlife rehabilitators and centres, they've had to stop taking in sick and injured birds just because of the slight risk both to the animals that are already in their care, but also to their staff and to their volunteers, because close proximity to the birds is, you know, it could potentially be something that would cause this disease to spread into humans. I know when we had a few years back, there was a, you know, very serious outbreak of avian flu, and there were several people, particularly in parts of Asia, who tragically did die. They contracted this from birds and developed that disease, and then in some cases died, which is horrible. But I think at that time, in the media was a lot of scaremongering, saying this was going to run rampant through the population, it was going to cause mass deaths around the world. That didn't happen. And just to stress and reiterate to people, it turned out that in the cases of several of the deaths in Southeast Asia, unfortunately, there were people who were involved in cockfighting, of all things. And one of the things that I believe in that, you know, that abhorrent world where people do that, I think that what happens is to make sure the birds are fighting fit, and before these bouts, they would put the bird's beak and head, you know, whole head into their mouth and suck the mucus out of their airways. And this is how the infection got into human beings in that area. So obviously that's a very extreme case, but it does show you that you do need to have, in most cases, significant contact with fluids, bodily fluids from these birds, and so do resist the urge to pick them up, or if you see any sick or injured bird, much as I hate to say it, don't take it into care. It's a horrible thing to have to think of, but just in case there's a problem with that bird, you have to put your own health first.
The lengths people go through for that sort of stuff. There's a few lads around here into a bit of cockfighting. I must keep an eye on them. They don't have a runny nose in the next few days. Another thing we've done, we've sort of stopped visiting seabird colonies for any of our work or monitoring that requires sort of direct contact or to be within the colony. So we've stopped sort of our seabird ringing and any of that sort of the colony visits. So we're trying our best not to spread it between colonies, because obviously some of our seabird workers and staff will be going from colony to colony. It would be quite a sort of silly thing to be sort of dragging anything between colonies. So we've just taken the precaution just to stop all that work for now, and the department has asked everyone else to do that as well. So any of the universities or national parks rangers or anyone that might be working on colonies, they've all ceased that work as well. So I think that's important to mention. Moving on slightly, in the connected world, there's a species of kleptoparasitic seabird, which is, you'll explain what that means in a second, Niall. The Bunxie or the Great Skua are badly affected by the disease. Because of the nature of their ecology. You might tell us about that.
Yes, so that word that you mentioned there, kleptoparasitism, that means basically they make their living by stealing food from other birds. They're pirates. So the skuas, I always think of them as real bird watchers' birds, because a lot of non-bird watchers aren't even aware these things exist. For bird watchers, they're kind of like really sought after species. We have four species of skua that are regularly seen in Irish waters. And of those, the great skua, or the Bunxie, is the largest. I often describe them as being something like a cross between a large gull and a grizzly bear, if that makes sense. Just something very bear-like almost about them. This big predatory seabird. Structure is very much like a gull. They're brown with these white flashes in their wings. We have a small number of pairs breeding in the northwest of Ireland on some of the islands there. But Scotland is home to the biggest breeding colonies of all of this species. And the archipelago of St Kilda particularly has a huge international importance for them. And recently I was talking to one of the wardens out there on the islands when I was doing something for Mooney Goes Wild, and he was saying that they're actually at this point concerned actually for the future of that species. They're worried the great skua may actually go extinct because of the effects of avian flu on them, because the impacts have been absolutely catastrophic. Because of their predatory nature and their piratical nature, what they do is they have more contact with other birds than even the average seabird would. You know, if they saw a dead or dying seabird, they would definitely go in and try to eat it. They would scavenge its remains. And it seems, therefore, that they're ingesting the virus and being infected very, very badly. I think also at places like St Kilda, fresh water is hard to come by. It's a place that wouldn't have much by way of running water, or any indeed rivers or streams. So when there's pools of water that gather on the island, Ireland, a lot of the birds go to bathe there, and the school seems to particularly do this. They'll travel quite a distance to bathe in these communal pools of fresh water. This virus lingers there, and it seems that's what's causing the infection as well. So we thought we'd highlight it as our bird of the week, because it's a bird I think that people don't know enough about, and one certainly we're now worried about. A bird that I would often see if I'm going on the ferry, let's say, across from Dublin to Holyhead or something like that. I'm always scanning out to see a Bonksy flying past the deck at some stage. You often see them way out over the open ocean. You see them often around seabird colonies too, because they go in to try to steal eggs and chicks. But it'd be a real shame if that species was lost, especially because people don't really know about it, and I think it deserves to be known better.
Definitely. I'm delighted to bring back Bird of the Week, but it's an unfortunate link to bird flu, but it is a real link, unfortunately, for that species. But they're just mega. I've only ever seen a handful, and it's always been from boats like you described there. And the books say they're herring gull size, but they seem much larger in real life. They're very deeper, deeper belly, and they're almost like a big sort of tough. The other thing that amazes me about them is further size. They're very agile. I mean, they can torment and hunt down and outgun most seabirds and get what they're looking for, and that's for a gannet or whatever to puke up its lunch, and then off the Bonksy will go with it.
Yes, that's a very good example with the gannet, because the gannet is considerably bigger than the Bonksy, but you see it's still terrified of it, and they're trying to make these birds get to the stage where they regurgitate or vomit up their food so that the skua can then catch it. And it's quite interesting when you do get a chance to watch them. They tend to flap along, and they do look very gull-like when they fly, that sort of big, sort of languid kind of flap. But then when they see potential prey or potential victim, something in their aspect just changes. They suddenly become more malevolent somehow, and all of a sudden they take on the aspect of a bird of prey. And you think, oh wow, this is something quite interesting, really. And they also, like birds of prey, the beak is very interesting. They have a longish beak like a gull would have, but the end is very hooked like a bird of prey. And it serves both purposes. So as a gull would have it, it's great for scavenging and picking away at carcass and things, but also the hook can be used to kill and to tear flesh even more effectively. It's a real brute of a bird, and I mean that with the greatest possible respect. They are a lovely bird, and one that's just a small breeding population here in Ireland. We're hoping that might expand eventually, but it's again the risk of avian flu may put paid to that, which we don't know yet.
A brute is the perfect description of them. They're just pure brutes, right? They're so few and far between, I suppose. There's not really anywhere we can point to go and have a look that, you don't want to build anyone's expectation, because it is difficult to see them. You'd have to spend a lot of time sort of at sea or knocking around seabird colonies to come across them quite often. But I would recommend anyone to sort of have a Google and YouTube Great Skua, and just see their behaviour and the carry on of them. They're quite cool. Tell me, we skipped over, why are they called Bonksy? What's the crack there? They're almost like most birders I know refer to them nothing other than Bonksy.
I believe it's an old folk name, I think, from the Shetland Islands. So that's what the locals called them there. I think it goes back a long, long way. Like a lot of things in the Shetlands, I suspect it may have some sort of Norse origin. Maybe so. But yeah, they have quite a few names like that. So they call the black guillemot, they call the Tisty, or the Tisty sometimes up there as well. So it's one of these old Scottish island folk names, probably of Norse origin, I think. So yeah, but I think maybe because Bonksy, it's quite an endearing kind of term, and it rolls off the tongue a lot more easily than Great Skua does. That's I think the origin of it.
So just to wrap things up and a bit of a summary. So if you're out on your holidays along the coast, you're seeing carcasses or strange behaviour in seabirds or any birds, the sort of thing we've described, is you need to get in touch with the regional veterinary office or the disease hotline that the Department of Agriculture, Food and Marine have on the go. And you get those numbers on our website on the news section, birdwatchireland.ie. Or if you Google it, you'll find the department's sort of links directly. Looking forward to coming back next week with a bumper episode about barn owls, which I know people are going to really enjoy. They're a species that people just love to talk about and see, of course.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that one. The barn owl is one of my favourite birds. That's going to be a blast. And just to say, as we always do, if you're interested enough to listen to Ricky and I prattle on about birds, these podcasts, you're exactly the kind of person that we need to convince to join Birdwatch Ireland as a member. Because as a charity, we rely on your support to conserve barn owls and to conserve seabirds and do more of this work. work. So you go to birdwatchireland.ie, you'll find full details there about how you can join Birdwatch Ireland, or how you can make a donation, or however, or buy products from our shop, or whatever way you'd like to support us as a charity. And then just to finish by saying again that the In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Leash and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage, and this podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.